is case number 76595, Chad Seatbelt versus Donald Griffey and DNR Hydrant. It's the time set for the oral argument. Mr. Schrager's here for the appellant. This is part of the pro bono program. Thank you very much for accepting this case. And you may proceed. And Ms. Rao for the respondent. All right, please be seated. Would you like to save any time for rebuttal?
I will go ahead if it pleases Your Honor and reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
It may be more, maybe less. It happens how it happens. Thank you, and good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Bradley Schrager, and as you said, I'm here representing the appellant, Chad Seatbelt. I don't know whether I'll use the whole 12 minutes. This is a relatively simple affair. In fact, I have the sense that this is the kind of case that would be decided on the papers were it not for the Court's indulgence to pro bono appointed counsel to afford oral argument, and I'm not going to pass.
Is that one of the reasons you took the case pro bono, or you're just a very giving person?
It's a side perk, Your Honor. I'm not going to miss the opportunity. Your Honors, this case presents a particular set of unfortunate circumstances and convergences that resulted unjustly in the end of this suit. We have the controversy that produced the lawsuit between my client and the respondent involving the breach of an agreement to bestow certain interests in the company and other related matters. We have a pro se litigant, a plaintiff gamely trying to articulate his claims in his complaint and at hearing, apparently unable to do so to the satisfaction of the district court. The district court was both courteous and polite and encouraging of the pro se litigant, but at hearing returned again and again to what we now know to be a fairly inaccurate statement of the law regarding the application of facts.
This isn't a legal question, but that's kind of the problem with the pro bono program. It's great that a lawyer of your stature and experience can come in here and argue before us, but he really needed you down below, didn't he?
Yes.
And unfortunately, that doesn't, the district court doesn't have the same program that we do, but that's one of the things that when you do take a pro bono case that you're unfortunately stuck with is you're stuck with a record that exists.
Entirely true. And one aspect of that is, one question you get when you're dealing with appeals of pro se matters is, okay, what is that supposed to matter to the court before it and then to your court? Don't the rules apply equally to everyone, no matter who they are, what sort of litigant they are? And of course they do. But the matter, obviously, dealing with individual pro se litigants, you've all been judicial officers in lower tribunals, is largely a matter of style. But the obverse of the question of don't the rules apply to everyone is absolutely that avoidable technical legal misfortunes should not befall a litigant simply because they are pro se, improper person. They should not have to suffer consequences that would be abnormal in the normal course. And I'll absolutely say this, and I think it's very clear. There is no way that a professional litigator would have left that courtroom below without clarifying and struggling mightily against the notion that it had been determined that no claim could be made within the statute of limitations. It's simply not clear, even at this moment, that that's true. So what happened was the district court, apparently on a misconceived notion of the application of the facts as presented to him and the statutes of limitation, not clear which, it sort of includes both in the order, the 4 and the 6 year for a written instrument and an oral instrument, resulted in dismissal with prejudice against my client. Now, my client filed his case in the fall of 2017, and the defendant didn't answer. He filed for a clerk's default in January of 2018, and he received that. That's a fairly easy thing to do, right? You file, you get your clerk's default. Then he attempted to set up a default judgment. That's a more technical and difficult scenario, and my client was unsuccessful. He didn't get it right, and the district court told him so. You need much more documentation. This is not how we do it. It's at that point that the defendant enters the case. And it's worth pausing on that for 1 second, because that's, again, a fairly routine matter of course thing for a litigator to undertake. You come into the case and you say, I didn't represent him, we didn't answer, I'm here now, the default judgment hasn't been ordered. And as a matter of course, those are routinely granted. Now, what's the number one reason why that's true? Because of, in this jurisdiction, as in all others, we hear cases in Nevada on the merits as far as we can, right? So defendants took advantage of that basic argument. Let's hear the case on its merits.
How did they do that, though? No motion was filed to set aside the default.
That's correct. at the default judgment hearing, as I understand it from the transcript, the defense merely appeared, and the default sort of evaporated. Right.
I thought the default judgment hearing was set subsequent to the hearing on the motion to dismiss, so it never really occurred.
There were a sort of, it's sort of clear the sequence of events, but the exact thing you're talking about, Chief Judge, is how did the clerk's default get lifted?
Or did it ever get lifted?
I don't think there's anything technically in the record saying that, but the case proceeded as if. Right. Another flaw that perhaps a professional litigator may have pointed out at the time. Right? That didn't occur. Afterwards, my client attempted to amend his complaint. And again, didn't quite get it exactly right. Right? Didn't serve it properly. Probably had the right to do so because an answer hadn't been entered. Right? But that was never the operative complaint. The only operative complaint in this matter is the original complaint. So the defense files a motion to dismiss, and they go to hearing in May of 2018. And it's in this hearing where the district court is attempting to elicit from my client the information it needs to make the ruling that it, at that moment, believes it needs to make. It's not easy to do. My client is not a sophisticated attorney, didn't go to law school, didn't sit through a whole year worth of contract law, none of those things. So the things that a professional litigator, as a matter of course, would have insisted upon at that hearing didn't occur. The number one thing that would have been insisted upon was, let's determine, let's find out, because it's not an, look, let's be perfectly honest. Complaint in this case is not perfect. It's probably not even adequate. The question is there, are there no set of facts from which my client could make out a case within the statute of limitations? If it's clear that he cannot, then dismissal with prejudice, obviously, is entirely appropriate.
What do you believe is the correct statute of limitations that should be applied in this case?
The order itself seems to encompass both sections of 190, 11-190, both an oral and a written instrument. So the order itself sort of waffles. Because I think in the end, given the fact that the court said, okay, I've elicited the notion that this agreement was entered into in 2010, and you didn't bring your suit until 2017, it doesn't really matter, right? 2010, 2017, 4, 6 years, not really the point. It doesn't matter. So it appears to me from the record that my client is alleging an oral agreement. That would make it 4 years.
So as for the contract claim, but as for the breach of the fiduciary duty, it's a different situation.
It is. It is. Now, the problem with dealing with that part of it is that the order itself doesn't say partial dismissal. It says this matter is dismissed with prejudice. And so when I come into the case, there is nothing to be done. You know, I mean, it's, some of these questions are pointing toward, couldn't some of this have been cleared up with motions to reconsider or Rule 60 motions to sort of deal with those orders? Probably. By the time we arrived here, we were dealing with full dismissal with prejudice, and my appointment from this court was to handle this appeal. So some of the questions you're asking are almost rhetorical in that.
Well, let me ask you this. So granted that the district court's order of dismissal is not, well, it has issues in it, okay, but under the facts as I understand them, your client is alleging that there was an oral agreement, I can't read the initial agreement, 2008 or 2010, but by 2000, and it was specified performance by 2012. Now, after 2012, and in 2012, performance was not delivered. Now, after 2012, there were subsequent negotiations, modifications, you know, all that kind of stuff. But can't the argument be made that in 2012 he had inquiry notice that there was a breach of at least the original agreement, and that's when the clock starts running? I know that's not what the district court actually said, but isn't that an alternative set of facts here?
That argument could exist. It's not clear from the record. And it's not clear because, you know, frankly, well, once again, going back to the lack of legal sophistication of my client would not know to explore theories of repetitive breach or ongoing breach or a renewal of the agreement. Right? There are all manners of claims that might arise if the facts were clearer from the complaint. And so what we're doing here today, what we're trying to correct is, okay, if there are claims let's have them made. It certainly cannot be clear from this record that there are no set of claims possible given what my client alleges happened, even though it's not as clear from the complaint. I absolutely concede that. It cannot be clear. It's not clear to me. It couldn't have been clear to the district court at that time. There's no real findings in the order. The order simply says, statute of limitations, dismissed with prejudice. That seems to me to go far beyond in sort of extinguishing my client's rights. And look, I don't know whether in the event that he's permitted to amend his complaint, I don't know that he'll do that. That's not the point here today. The point today is he doesn't have that opportunity. However, with...
So if this case gets remanded, hypothetically, are you going to continue to represent him, or are you just doing the appeal and then you're off the case?
That is a matter for my client and I to discuss. I'm certainly happy to do it. What I can assure you is that his claims will be vetted by a professional litigator so that they will be made or not made properly given the facts that he can bring forth. Right?
With respect to this particular oral contract, there was, in fact, partial performance of that contract in 2014. Is that correct?
That's the allegation, and that's a very important point that I wanted to bring up because that's something that opposing counsel raises in her brief. Now, if that's true, there may in fact be problems with that performance that give rise to claims for breach of contract. And in 2014, it wouldn't matter if it was written or unwritten. By 2017, it would still be a viable claim.
What was the error of law that the district court made, or that you are alleging the district court made in applying the statute of limitations?
The district court found, not in the order, but at the hearing, elicited from my client, okay, when are you alleging this contract was entered into? When did it form? And it appeared to be 2010. What the district court never got to was, when are you alleging the breach? What is the thing you're alleging is the breach? Now, I agree that should have been clear at the time, and it wasn't. But what the district court didn't find was, here's when the breach is alleged, and now let's apply the 4 or the 6 year period to that. What the district court found, and I'm, again, using that phrase loosely because it's not in the order, only from the hearing transcript, what the district court found was, well, you didn't file your suit until 2017. That's a 7 year gap. So the statute of limitations knocks you out. And under, I mean, if that were true, we know it's not a correct statement of contract law. But if that were true, then dismissal with prejudice would be reasonable, right? Because there would be no set of facts. You could show, here's the opening date, here's the ending date, right? You could do that. That was not done. Now, let's talk for 1 second, if I may, about when dismissal with prejudice is appropriate.
Do you want to save time for rebuttal?
I'll say this as quickly as I can and then sit down. It has to do with whether no set of facts can be shown. Now, I'm not saying that a set of facts absolutely can be shown that make these claims. I know from this record, I can't say, and I don't think the district court could say, that there are no set of facts from which it could be shown. And so what we're asking the court today is provide Mr. Seifelt with his opportunity to have his case heard on the merits in a way that most litigators, most litigants, most parties would get the opportunity as a matter of course, because as we know, leave to amend is to be freely given. Here it wasn't asked for. Perhaps Mr. Seifelt didn't know to ask for it. It wasn't discussed. It was simply in the order that this is with prejudice. And so to move forward at all, Mr. Seifelt asks that this court instruct the district court that if he's going to dismiss it, it should be without prejudice and would leave to amend. And if you have no questions, we'll reserve the rest of it for rebuttal. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schrager. Ms. Rowell.
Thank you. Tracy Rowell on behalf of the respondent. I agree with counsel's initial statement that this is sort of an unusual matter to orally argue given the underlying facts and the dismissal with prejudice being a relatively limited legal issue. I do assert that our trial court gave the appellant a number of opportunities to display facts or reveal facts.
So before we get to the next, let me pick up on a question that Chief Judge Givens asked your counterpart here. So you came into the case, I don't know if I can remember if it was you or another attorney, but you came into the case when the case was in default. And before you even asked for the default to be withdrawn, you just filed a motion to dismiss. So the question is, how does a party in default get to file a substantive motion?
Well, some clarification on that. It was my office that was retained after my client received the notice of the intent in regards to the default and then made the appearance on the hearing that had been noticed by the clerk's office in relation to the default on the 24th of April. After filing a notice of appearance in the district court matter, so we made that appearance, everybody showed up, I said, hey, I'm here now, at which point the district court issued some direction to the plaintiff in regards to the deficiencies of that effort to default. The district court then said, okay, there's this motion to dismiss, which, yes, my office did file shortly after being retained, after, of course, close examination of the complaint and identifying its defects. The district court said, okay, we'll be back on the, I believe it was the 15th of the following month on the motion to dismiss. We'll see you then.
But the district court did not actually set aside the default at that point.
Is my understanding, is that as a procedural matter, that is... As a practical matter, of course, the case went forward on the motion to dismiss, but technically, no.
All right, and Ms. Rao, in your brief, you argued that the plaintiff, now appellant, had ample chance to amend his complaint. Well, he tried to amend his complaint, and he didn't follow the exact correct procedure. The court talked about it at the hearing, but the court never actually said, now, if you follow the correct procedure, you can amend it, or... You're allowed to orally amend it. How would you like to orally amend it? So did he really get a chance to amend his complaint if there were deficiencies in it?
Well, he did seek to file an amended complaint, basically in reaction to the motion to dismiss, which, again, was procedurally not appropriate, and the rules were not followed. I do concede that the district court did not specifically instruct him on how to do that, how to amend his complaint such that it would be appropriately before the court, but I would go on to assert that I would say that that is probably not the job of our district court to stand in place of sort of advocate or rendering legal advice to the litigant in that capacity.
Right, but it's relevant in the context of whether a dismissal with prejudice would be granted versus a non-prejudice, and that's one of the main points the appellant is making. This shouldn't have been with prejudice. It was premature. There's a case that could be made, and even if the complaint was very inartful, it wasn't impossible unless the statute of limitations applied, and because there's no finding as to when the breaches occurred, you cannot even judge when the statute ran.
Those points are well taken. I would say that the initial complaint filed by the plaintiff is difficult to understand in any capacity, as was his opposition to our motion to dismiss. So I can form the opinion that, based on everything that the appellant had before the trial court, the assessment was there just isn't anything there.
Ms. Rao,
please.
Would you agree that and I know this was just a clerk's entry of default, but that should have been set aside before your motion to dismiss was addressed? Because technically, if there's a clerk's entry of default, the case is in default. So why would consideration even be given to amending a complaint or addressing a motion to dismiss at that time?
Certainly that it was not dealt with procedurally in regards to the default and removed on the record could present as problematic given the fact that the motion to dismiss was argued subsequently. I do assert that the district court was thorough at the hearing in April about the deficiencies with the default, how that's not going to happen here. We're going to go forward and hear this motion in the next couple of weeks, I believe it was, so that as a practical matter, I don't believe that the technical failure to enter the dismissal of the default, I'm not sure that's the appropriate term, should operate to render ineffective somehow the subsequent motion to dismiss and the ultimate finding of the trial court that statute of limitations was not met in the matter.
Do you believe the statute of limitations in a contract action, whether it's a written contract or a verbal agreement, runs at the time that the breach occurs?
Certainly, I think that is an effective interpretation. I would further, however, add that given the challenges presented by the appellant's complaint, and again, sort of reiterated to an extent in the his written opposition to our motion to dismiss, it made some sense to start with sort of the basics here. Do we even have a contract? Is it, in other words, a breach only flows assuming that there, was the formation of a contract. And I would respectfully assert that that's far from clear on everything that the appellant put before the district court.
So is the respondent's position that there was not a contract at all?
Certainly, yes.
So if that's the case, why was there partial performance in 2014?
Well, that was an allegation made by the appellant. Basically, the parties share a familial relationship.
Okay.
So that is certainly an operative dynamic in this. Yes, just to clarify, it is our position as a matter of law that no contract was formed. Hence, no breach is possible.
What about the other claim, the fiduciary duty, that was not addressed by the district court?
We would assert that fiduciary duty would not, or a breach thereof, would also not be applicable on these facts, given the facts that the alleged contract sought to or hoped to award the appellant an interest in this company. And absent that, there would, of course, be no fiduciary duty to be breached.
Well, but you're kind of diving deeply into the merits of the case now. All we have here is a motion to dismiss for failure to comply with the statute of limitations. And the standard for that is, if the facts are undisputed, then you can apply the statute as a matter of law. But if the facts are not undisputed, then you can't just dismiss the case. I know you're saying there's no contract, there's no breach of fiduciary, but that's sort of way past where we are, isn't it?
It is. Again, I confess the challenges of this, again, given the fact that the appellant's complaints and the information he put before the court, both in pleading form, opposition to motion form, and at argument, as elicited by the trial court, doesn't render a whole lot beyond sort of supposition and, I'm entitled to something.
Are you saying that his complaint, as it exists now, is insufficient to even plead the existence of a contract, and so there's no contract claim?
Yes, that would be our position.
Right, and of course, we looked at that, but should we be looking at what the district court decided when the district court indicated at the hearing that it wasn't concerned about the technical problems in the complaint, it wanted only to decide the statute of limitations?
Yes, that certainly was the focus of the trial court. I would assert that the trial court elicited and gave open forum. I think the exact statement was, "The floor is yours, sir," to talk with the court about the formation of this alleged contract, which is, of course, the basis for all of it. And he was given an opportunity to do just that, reiterated these dates that we've talked about earlier, 2010, this alleged partial performance, and nothing in that, even given a more inclusive view or longer view on a written contract as opposed to an oral, so the longer statute of limitations, gave rise to the court's understanding of its ability to hear anything given that time frame. And again, those were reiterated a number of times by the appellant.
Wouldn't that have been a finding for the district court to have made, and it chose not to go in that direction, and on appeal we're only dealing with the statute of limitations?
Certainly, if the trial court could have made more sufficient or more involved findings. I would agree on that. But again, on that...
So if you go back, hypothetically, if this is remanded in front of the district court, couldn't you then pursue that same claim again since the court never ruled on it?
Certainly. My client would be able to do that.
Of course, there might be an amended complaint in the meantime, too, that could change the dynamics.
In civil litigation, often, dynamics change on precisely those things. And I agree. I would assert, however, that as strong as the jurisprudential theories or underpinnings for decision on the merits, there should be also a regard for the fact that my client has gone to expense and time and stress to hold the appellant accountable to the legal standards necessary in order to move a piece of civil litigation forward in any regard in Clark County. With that, we believe that our district court generously canvassed him in order to avoid the finding of dismissal with prejudice and was not given the facts by the appellant in order to hang his proverbial hat on not issuing the order that he issued.
Well, this is typical of a pro se case. I mean, you were doing your job. The judge was doing his job. Mr. Seafelt was trying the best he could under the circumstances. It wasn't great, but does he suffer the ultimate consequence of dismissal with prejudice because of that?
We would assert yes. Again, he had a number of opportunities to do what need be done. Certainly there are self-help centers. I do a great deal of my work at our family courts here. I am amply familiar with the challenges of proper people litigants, but would respectfully assert same rules apply and should. And I have time left. But if there aren't any other questions.
Do you want to give that extra time in the spirit of pro bono work to Mr. Frank?
I'm actually happy to do that in the spirit of pro bono work. Unless your honors have additional questions.
You probably do a lot of pro bono in the family court arena.
I do a great deal of pro bono work, yes, in the domestic arena. We are a crowd section that way.
Okay. We do a great deal. And we hope you also volunteer for the appellate pro bono program, too.
Well, now, certainly. you can see more of me in that regard, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the gap is. There's pro bono cases in, you know, some people try to defend themselves in criminal cases. Obviously, there's pro bono cases in the civil civil area. But in family law, over 50% of cases are litigated pro se. I didn't mean pro bono, I mean pro se. Over 50%
yeah,
are litigated pro se. The whole area, the bar is crying out for attorneys more than any other.
It's so true. And the challenges presented are for the judiciary, for counsel, for the litigants themselves.
I mean, you're almost better off being charged with a felony because then you at least get the public defender.
or you know, family courts finding yourself, unfortunately, in front of an abuse neglect court for the same reason. So certainly the deficiencies or need is not debatable in that area.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Brown.
Very good.
All right, Mr. Schrager, you may have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and thank you, counsel. So I think we should address then what to do about the lack of the lifting of the default. That sort of threw everything into a sort of slightly gray area here because it has implications for your decision. Because that is, and I guess it's in the family of jurisdictional, right? What can happen next and what can a judge hear? I presume that vacating the order as is, or the decision as is, because of that, would still afford my client the opportunity, because obviously there would be no dismissal with prejudice, to amend, or at least ask for door for amendment. Still has a free amendment at the moment. Maybe there'll be an answer before then, but I could ask for the district court leave to amend. But I would urge the court as well to...
Is there any time left in the statute of limitations? I mean, I don't know how much time was left when the district court entered its order, but now we're another year or two past that.
Well, your order would relate back to originally, so the date of filing, which was the fall of 2017, would be the operative date. So I think that would take care of that issue. But I would urge the court to address the actual issues with the order as well, just to sort of have the belt set.
But it seems unlikely we would resolve this case on the default issue when, in fact, Ms. Rao made an appearance for the defendants, and the judge had a hearing, indicated he wasn't going to be granting any default judgment. So he just didn't issue three more magic words.
Exactly.
Default is vacated.
And this is sort of why it sort of evaporated in the case, because I presumed, as I've already said here, it's not that hard to get out from a clerk's default, right? That would occur. It was going to go forward.
Because a default judgment actually entered, then those standards are much more elevated.
Exactly right. Exactly right. That's the point where this sort of went into a gray zone. But I'll just say that the chief judge referred to dismissal with prejudice as the ultimate sanction, and I would urge the court not to permit that ultimate sanction when my client was merely unable to organize and articulate his allegations and facts. So certainly the gravamen of the allegations within the complaint are that there was an agreement and that there was a breach, right? So I don't think that's an issue for this court or the district court. So the fact that he was unable to organize and present all those facts as a professional litigator would, and remember, this is not a case where there were serial amendments where seven in a row were found to be futile. There's nothing of that nature. There's one operative complaint. He ought to be given the opportunity as a matter of course to amend and move forward. And with that, I'll say some words I don't think I've ever said in an appellate court. I yield back my time.
All right.
He didn't want your time. He yielded it back.
That means you'll be taking another pro bono case.
I'm always available, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schrager and Ms. Rao, and to the parties.